Good afternoon. This is Richmond Independent Radio News for Friday, October 14th, 2005. I'm Lauren Ball. This week, we have comprehensive debate coverage for the upcoming election. Richmond Sheriff's candidates Michelle Mitchell, C.T. Woody, and Emmett J. Jafari meet in Fulton Hill.
My experience has the breadth of knowledge to deal with the very complex problems of running an urban jail.
With your help, we can remove the blemish from the sheriff's office.
Well, you got to have a lot. There's just no getting around.
We'll also hear from Tim Kaine and Jerry Kilgore, two of the three candidates for governor of Virginia, who met for their final debate of the race on Sunday. And we catch up on the ever-changing affairs of the Virginia Performing Arts Foundation. Those stories and more coming up after these national headlines.
This is Pacifica Headline News. Filling in for Verna Avery Brown, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington. A prominent human rights group is claiming that people arrested for minor infractions in New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina hit are still languishing in jails across Louisiana and Florida. Leanne Caldwell reports.
Nearly 9,000 prisoners in New Orleans' local jails were transported to prisons around the state and some to Florida after Hurricane Katrina. According to Human Rights Watch, many of them arrested immediately before the hurricane were for petty crimes, including public drunkenness or vending without a license. They have yet to appear before a judge. Jamie Fellner is the director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch.
I think the district attorneys have to simply, you know, by fiat sort of said, okay, or the courts in New Orleans, those that are up and running, simply say, okay, we're just going to drop all the charges. And in fact, most of the charges would have been dropped anyway.
The paperwork has failed to follow the prisoners to the jurisdictions in which they were transferred, and local courts in New Orleans remain closed. For Pacifica Headlines, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Today, attorneys for detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay returned to a district court trying to get the Pentagon to release medical records of their clients. They say they have evidence that about 200 detainees are involved in a hunger strike, a number that contradicts the Pentagon's claim of only a few dozen. The attorneys say medical records could determine the truth. One of their lawyers, Guten Jolly Gutierrez with the Center for Constitutional Rights, explains why the detainees are in a hunger strike.
I think one thing that's important to understand is that the prisoners are striking simply for a fair hearing or for humane living conditions. And this is something that historically prisoners who are held outside the law resort to these kinds of hunger strikes in order to protest their living conditions and their indefinite detention.
A decision from a judge on the medical records is expected soon. Iraq closed its borders today and is imposing a strict nighttime curfew as the country prepares for Saturday's vote on the Constitution. Today, the office of a Sunni group, the Iraqi Islamic Party, that earlier in the week dropped its opposition to the Constitution, was bombed. Another of its offices was set on fire in Fallujah, and another was ransacked just north of Baghdad. Today, the group defended its support of the Constitution, saying that the deal struck with the Shiite and Kurdish leaders will allow disenfranchised Sunnis to participate in changing the Constitution next year. Other Sunni groups, however, denounce the compromise and are urging people to vote no. Nathan Brown is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace.
Politically, it does make for a slightly different situation in that you now have a Sunni leadership that is divided among those who support the Constitution, those who oppose it, and those who oppose the entire idea of a referendum and advocate boycott. And I think that makes it more likely for the Constitution to pass. I'm not sure it changes things that much legally or constitutionally. That is, I'm not sure it's going to make the Constitution operate that much more effectively. Mm-hmm.
And that was Nathan Brown with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. For the first time, the government of South Africa is forcing a white farmer to sell his land under a redistribution plan. The move came after talks between the farmer, Hans Visser, and the Land Claims Commission broke down. The government says it wants to hand over about a third of white-owned farmland to blacks who lost their lands due to apartheid by year 2014. Today, White House advisor Karl Rove testified for a fourth time to a federal grand jury investigating a White House leak that identified a CIA official. Unlike his last three visits, this time Rove has not been promised that what he says will not be used against him in a possible indictment. 3 months ago, Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper testified that it was Karl Rove who told him the identity of a CIA operative, Valerie Plame Wilson. She is the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who exposed George Bush's misleading statements that Iraq was attempting to buy uranium from Niger. Outing an undercover CIA official is a felony punishable up to 10 years in jail. Also on Thursday, Texas state prosecutor subpoenaed phone records of former House Republican leader Tom DeLay and phone records of his daughter. DeLay has been indicted twice on charges of violating Texas state election laws. Critics contend that the alleged violations led to an increase of Republicans in the House of Representatives. And finally, this weekend, scores of people are expected to converge in Washington, D.C. for the Millions More March and rally in commemorating the 10-year anniversary of the Million Man March. 10 years ago, about 1 million people came to the nation's capital calling for personal responsibility of men in black communities. This year, however, they are calling for government responsibility, particularly in light of the government's failure in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and its failure in providing adequate health care for over 40 million of its people. I'm Mitch Jezerich, along with Lona Elias and Leanne Caldwell for Pacifica Headline News.
For WRAR News, I'm Lauren Ball. On Sunday, October 9th, two of the three candidates for Virginia governor squared off on television in the last televised debate before the election. Democrat and Lieutenant Governor Tim Kaine met Republican candidate Jerry Kilgore to answer questions posed by a panel comprised of five journalists. Third-party candidate and Virginia State Senator Russell Potts, who is running as an independent Republican, was not allowed to participate in the proceedings, having not met the 15% polling requirement set by the sponsors of the debate. Each candidate was given 1 minute for opening statements. Tim Kaine used his 60 seconds to cite achievements of the current administration, in which he serves as lieutenant governor under Mark R. Warner. Candidate Kilgore focused on raising the issues he has with his opponent. Debate questions covered a range of topics from controversial issues such as the death penalty and abortion to inquiries as to the candidate's methods of decision-making and problem-solving. When the death penalty was brought up in questioning, Tim Kaine cited his Catholicism as a reason for his personal opposition to both the death penalty and abortion, but was adamant about the fact that he would uphold Virginia law regarding these issues and leave his personal beliefs out of his enforcement of those laws.
I'm Catholic. There's never been a Catholic governor of Virginia. I'm against the death penalty and abortion. That's what my church teaches, and those are the beliefs that I have come to believe in 47 years of adult life. I don't apologize for my religious belief, and I'm not going to change my religion just to get elected. But Larry, what I've always said is this. Just like any other person, I put my hand on a Bible, I swear to uphold the law, and I will uphold the law. So I'm going to uphold the laws concerning the death penalty in this country and in this Commonwealth.
On the issue of abortion, Jerry Kilgore expressed his belief that Democrat Tim Kaine placed to both sides of the issue to garner support from both sides of the political spectrum.
I've indicated that I'm the only pro-life candidate running in this race for governor. I support a culture of life, and I've supported reasonable safeguards in this arena. Parental consent, parental notification, protecting pregnant women and their children through the passage of Connor's Law. I do not support the criminalization of women. The individual who's being dishonest in this debate is Tim Kaine. He's running ads in Western Virginia claiming to be pro-life, yet he's campaigning in Northern Virginia and other places claiming to be pro-choice. He's indicated that he didn't support parental consent in the 24-hour waiting period during his campaign for lieutenant governor in 2001, yet he's now claiming that he supports those measures. I'm wondering, is Tim Kaine going to support pro-life measures, or is he going to be a pro-choice governor?
The issue of adoption by gay and lesbian couples was also hotly contested, with Kilgore coming out strong not only against adoption by gay couples, but also against gay marriage and civil unions.
Tim Kaine and I just disagree on this basic issue. I do not support gay adoption. I don't support civil unions either. Tim Kaine has supported civil unions throughout his career. He indicated that he believed that homosexual couples in long-term relationships ought to have the same rights and privileges as married couples in Virginia. I simply disagree.
Kaine had a more moderate view, but still intoned that he would not support the right of gay and lesbian couples to adopt children, although single gays or lesbians are currently able to do so under Virginia state law.
I support the current law of Virginia. The law of Virginia is this, that a married couple can adopt or a single person can adopt. Couples other than married couples can't adopt, whether they're sisters, brothers, unmarried straight couples, gay or lesbian couples, and I believe that the law is right, that a single person, including a gay or lesbian, can adopt in Virginia if it's in the best interest of the child. And there are many gay and lesbians who are wonderful parents,
who have gone through a searching review by courts, and the court has determined that it's in the best interest of the child that they be parents, and I would not undo that.
Other topics included affirmative action, specifically in the case of universities and colleges. Tim Kaine accused Jerry Kilgore of persuading Virginia Tech to abandon its diversity programs.
Virginia Tech had 4% African American students, and Jerry Kilgore, as Attorney General, muscled the Board of Visitors and got them to drop their diversity programs. And the result of that was that the minority percentage of 4% fell even lower. That was a battle he chose to fight. Just like he tried to fight against the Americans with Disabilities Act,
thank you.
This is someone who does not value diversity.
At the close of the debates, both candidates were asked to make a pledge to keep less than half of their advertisements for the remainder of the campaign as negative toward their opponent. Jerry Kilgore was reticent to accept those terms, citing instead that he stands by his advertisements.
I'll make the pledge, Larry, to stand by my ad. I supported that legislation and got that legislation through the General Assembly, and I am the reason that candidates now have to go on television when they're running an ad that compares their record to the record of their opponent and stand by that ad and say, I'm Jerry Kilgore, I paid for this ad. This race offers two candidates with very philosophically different views of the way the Commonwealth ought to be run. And we'll be doing comparative ads as we go through these final few weeks.
Tim Kaine agreed to the terms and went further to claim that he will keep well more than half of his future ads positive.
Yes, I will make a commitment on this stage that well over half of my ads will be positive because I've got positive news to tell, and that's what Virginians want to hear.
WRIR News has been in contact with Senator Russell Potts' campaign and will be featuring a dialogue with the senator in coming weeks. This is WRIR News. For WRIR News, I'm Lauren Ball. Last Tuesday in Richmond's East End, all three candidates running for the office of Richmond City Sheriff met to debate for the last time before the November elections. WRIR News reporter Dustin Richardson was there.
The Fulton Hill Neighborhood Resource Center is an unassuming former post office tucked away on a corner of Williamsburg Road near the Richmond National Cemetery. But it is the headquarters of the Greater Fulton Hill Civic Association, a tightly knit neighborhood organization that serves the areas of Fulton, Fulton Hill, and Montrose Heights, and last Tuesday night it was bustling with activity. Over 100 citizens showed up for the association's fall meeting, which included a debate between the three candidates running for the office of city sheriff. Normally, a sheriff's race in a big election year for the Commonwealth would hardly be noteworthy, but the office has been under a high amount of scrutiny this year. Much of the attention has been focused on the jail, as deputies and inmates alike complain about leaking roofs and locks that are easily compromised. The jail drew extensive media focus this past summer after an inmate was beaten to death, allegedly by another inmate who had broken out of his own cell and into the victims. This prompted Richmond Mayor Doug Wilder to create a committee to oversee the management of the jail. The three candidates include the current city sheriff Michelle Mitchell, former Richmond Police Homicide Detective C.T. Woody, and Emmett J. Jafari, a longtime veteran of the City Department of Corrections. For a solid hour, the candidates each fielded questions from the audience, as well as from moderator Donna Doro, vice president of the GFHCA. In his opening remarks, C.T. Woody went on the offensive, blasting Mitchell for a lack of progress in her 12 years as sheriff.
There has been a lot of threats and lawsuits, questionable spending practices, unethical decision-making. With your help, we can remove the blemish from the sheriff's office. Good leadership can occur regardless of the state of the facility that you work in.
But in her opening statements, Sheriff Mitchell defended her time on the job, blaming many of the department's problems on an uncooperative city government, while highlighting her experience over the other candidates.
I've spent my career, like I said, dedicated to the men and women behind bars. Unlike anybody else sitting at this table, my experience has the breadth of knowledge to deal with the very complex problems of running an urban jail.
Emmett Jafari also remarked on the failings of the department, but distanced himself from C.T. Woody by pointing out that Woody had spent his career working for the police, not the sheriff's office.
Contrary to what Mr. Woody's campaign is saying, and I really admire him for his 38 years of dedication, corrections is a whole different ball of wax.
All three candidates agreed that a new approach on the job was needed, given the recent tragedies. But they differed on one key issue early on, namely, whether or not they supported a privatized jail, as was proposed by the Wilder administration. C.T. Woody had mixed feelings on the subject.
Whatever the administration decides, they will still need a shirt. I believe very firmly in good leadership, accountability, and I feel that some of the cities that I know of that have privatization, they either have gone back to the sheriff's department because of a lot of civil suits and things in that nature. However, I'm willing to serve as sheriff, whether it's privatized or whether it remains the same.
But Sheriff Mitchell knew precisely where she stood.
The sheriff does not get to pick and choose what type of jail he or she may have. But I can tell you that my stand on privatization is I am not in favor of it. I realize that Richmond has some economic needs that really preclude us from paying for a jail out of the city coffers. But on the same hand, for me personally, I do not believe in corrections for profit.
Jafari agreed, but added that it was mismanagement, not the aging building, that is responsible for the department's problems.
Without knowing exactly what all is going into the details, I'm opposed to privatization. As I've said earlier, I don't think that the problem, apart from the antiquity of the jail, is the jail itself. I think that it's the way the jail's being run. And I think that when you change from the top and the way the job is done, you'll also change the way people do the job.
But things got heated when Donna Dora asked about funding for the jail. Woody again went on the offensive, saying that he would rather spend money on new locks than on replacing the roof, as Mitchell did.
You always need more funds, but it's no excuse for misusing the funds that you have. It's no excuse for not prioritizing. To me, as sheriff, it's more important to fix the locks and have the inmates on the most dangerous tier to be not only just locked up, but they have to be locked in. That's more important than fixing the roof. Let some of them get wet, but they would be locked in.
Mitchell responded by saying that for her, the roof took priority over the locks because of the severe overcrowding and that she lost the use of one of the cell blocks because of the leaks.
Again, there isn't enough money. And if I had to make the prioritization once again, it would still be the roof because I have to deal with the men and women who have to sleep on the floor.
But Jafari jumped right in and sided with Woody.
Well, you got to have the locks. There's just no getting around it. You have to have the locks.
But for the rest of the debate, Mitchell stuck to her guns and stood by her record, while Woody continued to point out that he'd pick better qualified deputies, and Jafari rallied for a tighter management style that only he could provide. But at the end of the night, Jafari summed up the sentiments of all three when he noted the significance of events such as this one.
When I see the turnout, it lets us know that this is a reflection of the importance that the community is placing on the sheriff's race this year. And that's very encouraging because it has to trickle down. We came in here as a group. I know you have the Civic Association. But you're going to have to make a choice as an individual when you step into that room where you pull the lever.
The Greater Fulton Hills Civic Association sponsored this debate as part of its mission to increase community involvement. If you would like to hear the full debate, tune in Monday at noon right here on this station. For WRIR News, I'm Dustin Richardson in Fulton Hill.
This is